good or not. Hey, as I said, I have this great interview here with Fatima Fakhari about her work as a writer, about perceptions of Muslims in the East or in the West. And had a great conversation. She was a wonderful interview. Links to her blogs and her writings are up on the website today. Check it out.
All right, folks, I'm here with Fatima Fakhari. She is an Iranian-American. She's a writer. She follows feminist issues, Muslim issues, is a media critic as well. MuslimaMediaWatch.org is, well, one of her websites. Also, FatimaFakhari.com. You won't be able to find that just hearing me say it, but there'll be a link to it on the website. Fatima, welcome to the program. Great to speak with you today. A couple of articles that I saw on your blog that I'd like to talk about. Fatima, I understand that one of the issues that you've been concerned about is a lot of places in the West are looking at banning veils or burqas or traditional clothes that Muslim women wear. What are your thoughts on this particular issue?
Well, the majority of the bans are regarding face veils,
mm-hmm.
so things that basically cover up the face, which a majority of Muslim women do not wear, actually. And I think this is kind of a non-issue. I mean, the majority of places in which these bans are being considered, in these places, the face veil just is not that prevalent. France, you know, who's like one of the first people to entertain the idea of these bans, has less than 400 women in the entire country that wear a face veil.
Wow.
And in a certain part of Canada, they were throwing around an idea to, in one of the provinces, to ban face veils at voting stations.
Mm-hmm.
But less than 5 women in the entire province wore the face veil that would hinder voting identification. So I kind of think that these bans are just impotent attempts to assimilate immigrant Muslims that end up further criminalizing them and reinforcing, or alienating them, rather, and reinforcing the xenophobic idea that Muslims don't belong. And, I mean, furthermore, the bans criminalize women's behavior. Banning veils and making them mandatory are two sides of the same coin. The end result is taking women's autonomy over their bodies away.
Well, and on some level, you wonder what the real target or audience for this sort of banning is. Is it really to go after this small percentage of women, or to make a statement to the general population, enforcing these stereotypes and sort of playing to the bigotry that's out there for political gain?
Exactly. I mean, they're always touted as, oh, you know, we want to do this for women, we want to do this to help Muslims, but it doesn't help them. It just makes them feel like they're being targeted.
Mm-hmm.
Even if they don't wear a face veil, they're like, well, but this ban doesn't apply to anyone other than Muslims, specifically Muslim women. So it just further alienates Muslims in the West.
And as you say, the majority of Muslim women do not wear them. They're essentially taking away that the woman's right to choose whether or not she prefers to wear the burqa.
Exactly.
Yeah, I mean, it just seems sort of, I don't know, interesting. And again, we're talking about Belgium, France, Canada. These are typically known for being free societies, open societies, where dissent and disagreement is something that is and diversity is something that is valued. Why do you think they feel so threatened by the veil, by the burqa?
That's honestly, I think a lot of it is simply just misunderstanding and fear.
Mm-hmm.
Specifically in Europe, they have not had huge influxes of immigration before.
Mm-hmm.
In the U.S., we have always had people of color. From the very first day the nation was founded, there have always been more than one type of people in this country. But in Europe, they haven't had to deal with people of color actually moving in next door.
Mm-hmm.
And because a majority of immigrants to Europe are from Muslim-majority countries, the issue is being kind of skewed to Islam more, racialized to Islam more than maybe it should be. But I think at the heart, this is an immigration issue, at least for Europe.
Interesting. Well, it's odd that they single out the veil of all the aspects of Muslim society or culture that are misunderstood or feared. It's odd that this is one that they single out. Because they can, because I don't know. It just seems like a strange place to draw the battle lines to me.
It is, and but I know, like, the UK, they have not. They've had dust ups with the face veil in the past. You know, with Jack Straw making comments about how it's not British, but they haven't actually considered a ban. However, what the UK has considered are bans on forced marriages, for example, and bans on female genital cutting, things that also aren't, you know, necessarily Islamic, but can often happen in the societies in which some of the Muslims immigrate from. So, I mean, I guess it just depends on the country and the perceived threat.
Right. I mean, in terms of, you know, well, the I guess mutilization is a very loaded word, but the alteration, I guess, of the female circumcisions, these sort of practices, I think you can understand a context of that it's about, and forced marriages, that you can understand that it does apply to other cultures, other religions, and it's something that affects all citizens of the country that is trying to legislate against that, as opposed to, you know, as you say, the burqa is a whole different range. There's only a very small percentage of a population within a small percentage of people within that population actually use the burqa. The other laws, I think you can sort of, they can make more sense because they apply to everyone.
Definitely. Yeah. Definitely.
And there is somebody who is, you could perceive somebody who is sort of a victim of these laws of wearing a, you know, what, it's hard to imagine the harm of a veil, essentially, and the uproar of legislating it. Another thing that's hard for Westerners, particularly people in the Christian world, to understand is the notion of the depiction of images of the Prophet Muhammad. There was an issue this week with the cartoon television program South Park. I think particularly for Christians who are, you know, well, at least in the States, obsessed with images of, you know, finding Jesus's image on a piece of toast, it's hard, you know, and being obsessed with that sort of thing. It's hard for sort of Christian Westerners to understand the Muslim reaction to depictions of the Prophet Muhammad.
Well, and I mean, these are also it's an issue that gets I'm sorry, you're going to need to edit this out, but
that's okay.
It's like 9 in the morning.
Yeah.
Okay. This is an issue that is multifaceted. Because as Aziz Poonawalla pointed out on his BeliefNet article about this, the Prophet has been depicted by non-Muslims and by Muslims with respect many times in the past. You know, on the Supreme Court building in D.C., there is a marble frieze depicting the Prophet as one of history's great lawgivers. You know, and many Muslim societies, specifically like in Iran, will depict the Prophet and his family, although, you know, they never show his face, usually. He is often depicted, and it is a reverent thing. It is you know, something that is out of love and respect. So, you know, I think the idea itself is mischaracterized because, you know, not everyone has a huge issue with depicting the Prophet, but you know, I think the biggest issue is with depicting the Prophet offensively.
Right. Well, it is interesting. I mean, is it... sometimes you get a sense that it's almost sort of the spark point for something deeper, a sense of a feeling that in the Muslim world that there's a lack of respect for the culture by Westerners. Well, I mean, there's a lack of respect of everything by Westerners. Let's face it. I mean, to see the depictions of the West's sort of deity, Jesus, depicted in some ways that would certainly offend people of that faith. Nothing is sacred in the West, and
Christ comes to mind.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's hard for us to sort of appreciate that, but isn't it, I think. Maybe it just stems from just something a little more deep-seated than the actual cartoon depictions, but an overall sense of a lack of sort of respect for the culture.
It could, but I also think that at least with the South Park controversy, you know, quote unquote controversy that isn't really one.
Right.
Most Muslims, I think, especially most American Muslims, even ones that were offended. You know, they realized that this wasn't worth making a fuss over. Because especially like being a Muslim in the U.S., there are a lot more serious things that I would be worried about. But this isn't, in my opinion, this wasn't even as big of a deal as the Danish cartoons. Those were much worse because their entire objective was to depict the Prophet offensively.
Right. They were trying to stoke a reaction, and they sure did.
Exactly. And while there were Muslims who did react, you know, badly with, like, death threats and violence, the majority of worldwide Muslims made it clear that this wasn't acceptable through economic and political boycotts. Death threats are never the answer. They never accomplish anything. And the majority of Muslims, even, you know, worldwide, know this. And like I say, I don't think this, I mean, this controversy just really wasn't one. And it's South Park, you know, making fun of everything and everyone is their thing. It's their whole point.
Right.
And the majority of the controversy came from CNN and these, like, two nut jobs who mouthed off on their website. And CNN legitimized these two clowns by giving them a platform. Instead of, like, you know, CNN should have gone to the Muslim Public Affairs Council or the Council for American Islamic Relations, but instead they talk to these two guys, give them, you know, a platform to spew their misinformation and hatred, and meanwhile, the rest of the majority of, like, American Muslims are like, who are these guys? What? Like, what? This is so stupid, you know? And especially because South Park already aired an episode in 2001, in July, that actually contained a human form of the Prophet in the episode about Super Friends. Nobody said a word about it then. And it's like, to make a big fuss now about an episode that doesn't even show the Prophet in human form just seems silly. I mean, it's obvious, I mean, from what I understand of the episode, it was not to make fun of the Prophet, but rather to kind of ridicule the flurry of censorship that surrounds him.
And so essentially the two people calling themselves Revolution Muslim essentially proved that point, didn't they? I mean, they sort of played right in the South, you know, the Matt and Trey hands in this one. That essentially they did this to sort of be controversial, and these guys gave them a lot more attention. There were probably more people tuned into that episode of South Park because of Revolution Muslim.
I don't think that the creators of South Park could have done it better.
Well, it is interesting because so often, these extreme points of view, the ones that come up, you know, this Revolution Muslim who nobody ever heard of, who don't necessarily speak for on behalf of anyone but themselves, are now sort of depicted as this is the way Muslims think of these things. It's interesting, though, that you know, we don't apply the same standard to the extreme Christians in our society. You know, when Falwell or Pat Robertson comes out and says this earthquake, this tornado, this hurricane was caused because there are lesbians in New York City. Nobody tags all of Christendom with that insanity. It's just, it's sort of just reserved for these specific nuts. The same isn't granted to the Muslim community. These things tend to sort of label the whole community as being irrational.
Exactly. I think this is an extension of the stereotype that Muslims are monolithic, that we all, you know, think the same way and act the same way and practice Islam the same way. when, you know, we're just like any other faith. Everyone thinks differently. Everyone practices differently. There are, you know, tons of different sects. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we all react differently. And a colleague of mine, Wajahat Ali, he's the author of Domestic Crusaders, he has this brilliant satire up on Salon.com right now. It's this hilarious parody of the South Park controversy. It's called East Park, I think. Mm-hmm. It's hilarious. You should really check it out.
It's at Salon? I'll have to check that out.
Yeah, Salon.com. It's up there right now, I think.
Right. Wow.
Like, this was his response, you know. He's mm-hmm. like, this is silly. I'm going to write a parody of this controversy. And then, conversely, you know, you have these two guys who are making veiled death threats on their, you know, their silly website.
Right. And obviously, you know, getting reactions. I don't know if you saw the piece. John Stewart reacted to it. I don't know if you saw the piece that he ended up with, you know, with the gospel choir that he's fond of these days. And, But I think his larger point was, you know, that it's ironic that these two guys in New York have the sort of freedom of speech to criticize and go after South Park for doing this, but the networks actually didn't grant the same level of free speech to South Park. They edited it. You know, they censored them. It's just sort of an interesting application of free speech, you know?
Yeah, it's a big tangled web.
Yeah, exactly.
It's very interesting.
Yeah. Hey, I saw on your website, to change the subject a little bit here, you were part of a White House press conference.
Yes, and I feel kind of nerdy about it because it was my first one.
Well,
I was kind of excited.
That's one more than I've had. that's pretty darn exciting. Tell us about what was the press conference about? And you even got to ask a question as well. Tell us about what the conference was about and what was your question? And was it answered?
Well, it was the press conference was last Friday, mm-hmm. and it was basically they held a call-in press conference for bloggers and social media makers about the Presidential Summit on Entrepreneurship, mm-hmm. which happened Monday and Tuesday of last week. And it's put on by the U.S. government, and it's basically it's like 250 delegates. Mm-hmm. from about 50 to 60 countries, many of them Muslim majority, but the participants are not all Muslims. They're not limited to Muslims. Mm-hmm. And it's basically, you know, an attempt to build long-term bridges and partnerships and kind of help budding entrepreneurs in other countries, you know, kind of give them a footing, give them resources, connect them with other, you know, more established entrepreneurs in other parts of the world and in their own countries. So this was pretty exciting for me to be on a White House press conference.
Yeah.
And because, you know, on Muslim and Media Watch, I focus on Muslim women's issues. I asked how the summit can help economically empower women mm-hmm. in these regions. You know, especially in Muslim-majority countries, women are, you know, slowly getting on their entrepreneurial feet. Mm-hmm. And they're like, you know, there's so much opportunity for them, and they're, you know, they're starting to grab hold of it. So I wanted to know kind of how the summit would encourage that. And there was an entire day, or at least half of a day on Tuesday. It was only a two-day summit. But on Tuesday, there was a special focus on female entrepreneurship mm-hmm. With the special representative to Muslim communities, Farah Pandit, and Valerie Jarrett and Hillary Clinton.
Oh, wow.
And, it was a pretty amazing event. They streamed the entire thing on the website also.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's interesting, you know, there's studies done, and I'm not sure if you're familiar with Rian Eisler. She's been sort of investigating, looking at gender roles and dominion, models of dominion over cooperation, really just a lot of fascinating work. She has a book out called The Real Wealth of Nations that talks about how we assign value to things. And one of the things that she's uncovered, there's a study done that in societies where women have entrepreneurial opportunities, where women have more rights, the benefits to society are just remarkable. Whether you're talking about GDP, health of the population, infant mortality rates, longevity of life, so many aspects of culture and society improve when women are given equal footing in business and in entrepreneurial relationships. It's actually a remarkable transformation of society. The most significant thing you can do to improve a society is improve the rights of women in your culture and society.
Definitely. I totally agree. A country cannot make progress if its women are not making progress.
Yeah.
And when you make things better for women, you know, they will make things better for everyone around them. They will make things better for their children, for their extended families. I mean, education and health for women are the only way that you're going to improve a society, in my opinion.
Oh, and the numbers are amazing. They actually break it down by if you give $100 to a woman in this society, it's just like $87 of it trickles into into children, into the cooks, into the community, and you know, help improving. If you get that same $100 to men, it's almost the exact opposite. Men are much more likely to spend the money on themselves, entertaining themselves, that sort of thing, as opposed to contributing to the health and well-being of the society and the family unit. It's remarkable what a difference it makes in the culture.
Yeah, on the press conference, the White House officials were talking about how Muhammad Yunus from Grameen Bank was going to be at the summit, and his microfinancing is the perfect embodiment of this idea. Like, if you give the money to women, exactly, they're going to invest it in their businesses, in their children. And I remember seeing an interview with him. At some point where he's like, you know, we tried to do this with men, but they spent all of it on alcohol and
gambling,
hookers, gambling. Whereas the women, not only did they spend it wisely, but they worked hard to repay it.
Exactly, and again, and this sort of bridges across all sort of cultures, societies, religious traditions. It doesn't matter in what context you look at these numbers; it's the same in every society with relation to the way women and men handle money and what it means for the culture. It's a remarkable study.
Exactly. Yeah.
Fatima, thank you so much for speaking with me today. We'll be airing this interview on Monday. I will send you links to the recording of the interview and to the actual show itself. And I'm really enjoyed our conversation this morning, as early as it was for both of us. And,
thank you so much, Jeff. It's been wonderful speaking with you, too. Thank you so much for having me on the program.
Thank you. I hope we can do it again.
My conversation with Fatima Fakhri. I hope you enjoyed that. Stick around, folks. We got lots more coming up, lots more show coming up for you. On the other side of this break, we'll have Gregory Siskin with us. We're going to talk immigration, specifically SB 1070. Stick around.
Things I've heard. Everybody find mercy when they don't know. A bad enough situation is sure enough.